From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
I am no longer actively pursuing the presidency.
And with that, the doctor was out. Howard Dean's announcement after his dismal third-place showing in the Wisconsin primary surprised few. But since then, we've seen campaign obituary after campaign obituary, each doing its best to explain what on earth happened to the candidate who a little over a month ago was the undisputed favorite for the Democratic nomination. Some blame Dean for not keeping his cool, and some blame his staffers for squandering the campaign's nest egg. Many blame the media. But one of the most compelling explanations we found suggests that Dean's lead never actually existed to begin with. Clay Shirky, an expert on the sociology of the Internet, wrote in his weblog Many to Many that, quote, Dean's campaign didn't just fail, it dissolved on contact with reality. And he offered a useful metaphor for understanding the collective delusion, the corporate letterhead.
In the old days, if you got something on corporate letterhead, it meant there was a solvent company behind it because they had the money to get someone to design the letterhead, they had the money to have it printed and stored somewhere and so forth and so on. And along comes the desktop publishing revolution. And so suddenly, you know, as an individual with no incorporation, no lawyer, no clients, I can create corporate letterhead and send it off. And anybody who looks at that letterhead, at least in the early days of the desktop publishing revolution, said, oh, my goodness, you know, this person must represent a really big company. And over time, we've come to realize that sophisticated graphic presentation is no longer emblematic of large resources behind it. I think that a lot of what happened is that the Dean campaign created the political equivalent of desktop publishing letterhead, that it made so many previously hard things easy that we all came to believe that he'd made getting votes easy as well.
Let's talk about the thing that first caught the attention of some campaign reporters, the seemingly spontaneous turnout of 300 people at a Howard Dean meetup in New York City in early 2003. This sort of thing was unprecedented.
We assumed that that was a sign of enormous latent strength. And I feel, you know, especially dumb for having missed this because, of course, what Meetup was actually founded to do, actually, full disclosure, I'm an advisor to the company, was to lower the hassle of getting people together in the real world. So it wasn't so much that those 300 people signified that there was this huge upwelling of support for Howard Dean, but rather that if you supported Howard Dean, it was now much, much easier to gather with like-minded individuals. But what it means is that you can no longer look at the number of people who turn out for a particular cause or candidate as evidence of a much larger pool of support.
So it is, in effect, the desktop publishing-produced letterhead.
Right.
You've just found a new tool.
And in this case, they found several tools in successive order. It wasn't just a kind of one-off novelty. There was Meetup, but there was also the involvement of MoveOn. There were weblogs. There were mailing lists. There were wikis, which are these collaborative workspaces where people were working out policy. There was the incredible fundraising story. And all of that stuff together produced a set of numbers that in past elections and for other candidates have been incredible predictors of electoral success as well. It looks in retrospect like what Dean had done is lower the difficulty of doing those kinds of things, raising money and turning out supporters, without lowering the difficulty of getting people to actually go for the polls and push the button for Dean.
Okay, Clay, I hear what you're saying. However, apart from the media coverage and the cover stories in Newsweek, the poll numbers were very good. He had a gigantic lead in New Hampshire and in Iowa that did, in fact, evaporate. What do you make of that?
Well, they only evaporated if they were there, and they were only there if polls are the same as votes. And we've gotten so used to polls predicting votes that we've treated them as the same, but they're actually two different kinds of things. A vote is a one-off and non-binding choice. A poll is essentially an opinion offered for public consumption. Dean offered a really direct and muscular challenge to a president who is hugely polarizing and therefore hugely energizing. And he did it on a number of issues that Democrats are usually afraid of, especially the war. And so up until people had to actually decide who to vote for, Howard Dean was pronounced anybody but Bush, right? And once people came around to having to decide not about general issues, but who they were specifically going to vote for in their state, I don't think Dean's support evaporated. I think the poll questions essentially became different. Instead of who's saying the kind of things you like right now, which are the poll questions last fall, it became very specifically, who are you going to cast your vote for? And those are two different questions, and we got two different answers.
All right. Well, then finally, we have seen how the internet can create the spiffy letterhead. Tell me how you suppose, looking forward, a small group of people using the internet can really change the minds of the largest part of the body politic.
You know, a lot of the initial effect around the Dean campaign was simply the novelty of the thing. The bloom is off that rose. So in the future, people will be able to pick up these tools without the kind of complicated effects of the press coverage about the tools, which seems to be about the candidate. That having been said, I think any campaign that picks up these tools faces a risk that the potential successes of using the internet to organize people or to raise money undermines their sense of how hard it is to get votes. The Dean base was famously energized. You know, they took on the name for themselves, Deaniacs. Margaret Mead once said, you know, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful and committed people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever had. You know, and of course, that's vacuously true. But the systems that run the modern world, democracies and markets, are actually designed to defeat exactly those attempted hijackings by small groups. You can't outbelieve the opposition. You have to convince other people to vote your guy in.
Clay, thank you.
Not at all. Thank you.
Clay Shirky is a consultant and writer on the social aspects of internet technologies. He teaches in the Interactive Telecommunications Program at New York University.
John Kerry has won 15 out of 17 states in his quest to be the Democratic nominee for president. Well, yes and no. In the presidential election, you win states. In the primaries, you win delegates. But still, the news reports talk about Clark winning Oklahoma, when really he picked up one more delegate than second-place finisher John Edwards. It's just one of the things that brings former OTM producer-at-large Mike Pesca here to talk about the press coverage of the primaries. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Brooke.
So you've been on the campaign trail covering the primaries for NPR's Day to Day. What do you think?
Well, you're right. The press usually gets beat up for covering horse race and not policies. So let's take a moment to talk about, well, you know, they're making some mistakes when they're covering the horse race as well. Let me read just a line from the Chicago Tribune the day after the Wisconsin primary. It talks about how John Edwards has clearly established himself as the alternative to the frontrunner John Kerry. It says, "They don't give trophies for second place in politics." Yeah, but they do give delegates. So the newsrooms across America all have the map of the country, which states that light up in different colors. But you can't really use those colors for a primary because in Wisconsin, all John Kerry won was six more delegates than John Edwards. That was Kerry's exact margin of victory as in Washington, D.C. And people didn't really pay that much attention to that particular vote.
So what do you think the media should be doing?
Well, I think there could be a delegate tote board in all the newsrooms. Tim Russert can go with the retro dry erase board, which he used during the 2000 election. And they shouldn't cover it like a horse race. They should cover it like a golf major.
A golf major?
Yeah, where you don't say Tiger Woods won hole three. You don't say even Tiger Woods won on Saturday. You say that Tiger Woods is three strokes ahead. It's always a cumulative process. During the New Hampshire primaries, I asked Paul Begala of CNN, who, of course, helped Clinton get elected, if there was too much emphasis placed on early contests merely because of their symbolism.
Is it a little like covering the first inning of the World Series exclusively?
No, it's like covering the first game of the World Series. It matters a lot. Whoever wins here has an enormous leg up on being the next president.
But on election night in Wisconsin, Jennifer Palmieri, who's communications director for the Edwards campaign, made this analogy.
If this were a baseball game, it would be the top of the third inning.
So you would agree with Palmieri, then, that it's an inning rather than a game, or maybe not a game at all?
Well, inning or game, it's an early part of the process. Really, anyone can win this election. That's not just a member of the media desperately hoping that there's a close race. It's really and truly not a done deal.
But let's say the horse race were being put in its proper perspective. Don't you think there still should be a little less of it?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about that. But the reason why the horse race is so legitimate is because it really is a tight race. And also because a lot of aspects of the horse race do tell us a lot about where we are as Americans. I mean, the way people campaign, and whenever you do campaign, you raise issues. So you could say that Edwards did well in Wisconsin, so far it's horse race, because he emphasized trade and NAFTA. Now you're talking about policy, and a lot of the stories have the blend of both of them.
As you mentioned, the media have been caught a little flat-footed when it comes to predicting the horse race. They anointed Howard Dean rather early, and now Edwards had the opportunity for the great line that objects in the mirror may be closer than they appear. How did the media miss him? Were they talking on the cell phone while driving?
I think this is an entirely poll-driven phenomena that they missed the Edwards surge. What happened was he got endorsed by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel rather late in the campaign. They couldn't take a poll which took into account that endorsement. And the big thing that happened was he felt he did very, very well in the debate. But the debate happened on a Sunday. Polls that were released on Monday really couldn't take it into account. And so it still looked like, oh, Kerry is going to crush Edwards. But it's just that all the good things that happened for Edwards happened too late, and Edwards wound up doing well. Edwards usually does better than the polls indicate on election day somehow. That's something to look into.
Yeah, it's something for campaign reporters, I would guess, to look into, especially if the latest polls are 3 days before the vote, and in many states the heat of the campaign lasts a week. That means the polls miss almost half the campaign.
Right. This Zogbee poll in Wisconsin came out the day before the vote, so it seemed cutting edge. But it surveyed people from February 12th to 15th. It came out February 16th, and the vote was February 17th. So it really missed the important things in the campaign that people used to decide on who to vote for.
So what's the next big moment to watch out for?
Well, everyone's looking for 2 weeks from now, Super Tuesday, as the contest that'll settle it all. But, you know, the John Edwards people say, actually, we're going to do a lot better. There are big states like Florida that vote the week after Super Tuesday. So let's not think that even if John Kerry wins 8 out of 10 states on Super Tuesday, that it's all over. I would just urge anyone to just look at the delegate count. That's all you have to do. If the networks don't put it up, it's out there on the web. Perhaps onthemedia.org can link to that, too.
All right.
That should be. Yes, I forced you into that one. But that should really be the story of the campaign. And forget about the number of states and forget about stories about who has momentum. You need 2,161 delegates to get the nomination. And until you're there, you don't have the nomination.
Mike Pesca is a correspondent for NPR's program Day to Day. Thanks for deigning to visit us again, Mike.
It was great. Bye, Brooke.
Coming up, grim views of the media in a new play by Tim Robbins and by Quantitative Analysis.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's become almost trite to observe that TV coverage of election campaigns obsesses on the horse race to the exclusion of the underlying issues. But a new study by MediaChannel.org quantifies the substance gap. Using data compiled in January by the monitoring firm MediaTenor, MediaChannel concluded that the three major network news divisions devoted less than 5% of their campaign coverage to the five issues voters say matter most: the economy, the war on terror, health care, education, and taxes. The same study found that candidates deemed marginal by the networks received virtually no coverage, and that President Bush, long gingerly treated, has been hit with a sudden barrage of negative coverage. Media Channel Executive Director Timothy Carr joins me now. Tim, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
Well, I'm curious about your methodology on a couple of fronts, but let's talk about the 5% figure. If, for example, there is a story about whether John Edwards is making headway on John Kerry, and the soundbite of John Edwards is him talking about fair trade versus free trade, in essence articulating his anti-NAFTA policy, doesn't that count, or shouldn't that count as policy coverage, even if it's in the context of a piece on the horse race?
In fact, it does. We look at all statements and we rank them according to what is said. So if, in fact, John Edwards refers to fair trade, we then register that as a statement about economic issues.
How do you determine what is negative or positive or neutral, and who is making that determination?
There are analysts who pore over transcripts and actually watch the broadcasts. They tape the broadcasts. And they will look at a story and make a determination that is qualitative, whether it is positive, negative, or neutral towards a candidate. So what we've seen in the last 2 months that we've been analyzing this coverage is that there has been a turn towards more negative coverage of George Bush. And this is not that the networks are giving negative bias to the stories as much as it is that they're presenting stories such as Bush's position on WMD, the problem with intelligence there, the somewhat flat reception to his State of the Union address, the brouhaha surrounding his service during the 70s, his military service. And they'll look at stories like that and they'll rank them as negative, but these rankings don't reflect bias. They really reflect the choice of news items.
Well, I want to ask you about that because in the media channel pieces that you've done analyzing the research as it's come in, it seemed to me that you equated an increase in the number of so-called negative references at CBS, for example, concerning President Bush, with the network's attitude toward Bush, as if someone had said, okay, it's time to go negative. But that's not how news organizations operate.
That's not how they present themselves, certainly. But it's interesting to note that at a time when CBS News was under fire for alleged right-wing bias in its decision to kill a program called The Reagans, its decision to reject advocacy campaigns during the Super Bowl, they have come under heavy fire from progressives in the left for allegedly supporting a right-wing point of view. At the same time, you see a very decided shift in the coverage of the CBS Evening News program towards negative. And they, in fact, came out to be more negative in their coverage of Bush than both ABC and NBC. The data presents an interesting phenomenon that deserves further coverage.
Isn't it more likely that the CBS News operation not only acts essentially independently of any corporate bias, but that it's just reacting to the news concerning the president?
That's true. However, it's difficult to say, you know, what influenced these organizations or how they came to the decision to present more negative or more positive stories.
I noticed a kind of paradox in your data. It turns out that the candidates who got the least attention got the most light shown on their policy positions.
The most positive light.
Yeah, Kucinich and Joseph Lieberman and Carol Moseley Braun, who are two who are now out of the race, got quite a bit of favorable coverage for their policy positions, while Edwards and Kerry lagged at the very bottom. How do you account for that?
Well, the coverage that they did receive was rather minuscule by comparison to the coverage early on that Dean received and that Kerry is now receiving. And it tended, whenever they would mention these lesser candidates, to portray their issue positions. But we're looking at candidates that garnered, in some cases, less than 1% of the coverage against Bush, against Dean, against Kerry, who are receiving upwards of 30% of the news coverage of election information. And unless they can raise a significant amount of money, it removes them from the media mix.
The state of democracy in the United States in 2004 is such that the game is stacked in favor of those who have the war chests to underwrite a long and grueling campaign. Should the national broadcast media ignore that political reality? Or are you suggesting that they should unilaterally try to change the political reality by devoting news resources and airtime
to those who haven't a snowball's chance in hell of ever getting elected?
Well, I don't think it's the media's responsibility to make these decisions. I think ultimately it's the public's responsibility. And what we're trying to do at Media for Democracy is empower the public to pressure the media to do better. Yes, money and media are powerful ingredients in deciding who ultimately will win the election. And the media is the recipient of campaign money. The majority of campaign money goes to local broadcast affiliates to buy these 30-second political ads. This is a system that has excluded the voters from the process, and we're trying to bring them back into this.
Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Timothy Carr is the executive director of Media Channel, a media watchdog group based in New York City.
Political satire is a blunt instrument, often wielded in the worst of taste. 500 years ago, Jonathan Swift, outraged over the poverty of the Irish, wrote a modest proposal calling for Irish children to be boiled and stewed. It would benefit both the poor and the rich, he suggested, by relieving the poverty of the parents and supplying the wealthy with a ready source of meat. Throughout American history, presidents have been similarly filleted. In 1967, McBird, a takeoff on Macbeth that likened Lyndon Johnson to the regicide Macbeth, played in Greenwich Village with Stacy Keach in the title role.
There's news, more news.
Spit out your spiteful news.
Peace paraders marching.
Stop them.
Beatniks burning draft cards.
Jail them.
Negras starting sit-ins.
Gas them.
Latin rebels rising.
Shoot them.
Asian peasants arming.
Bomb them.
Congressmen complaining.
F*** them. Flush out this filthy scum. Destroy dissent. It's treason to defy your president.
A few years later, novelist Philip Roth produced a brutally satirical play about Richard Nixon called Our Gang. Roundly condemned, he explained in an essay that, quote, satire is moral rage transformed into cosmic art. What begins as a desire to murder your enemy with blows is, quote, converted in the attempt to murder him with invective and insult. It's the imaginative flowering of the primitive urge to knock somebody's block off. Tim Robbins, what do you think of that?
I think that's a interesting and appropriate description of satire.
Actor, director, playwright, and activist Tim Robbins has written a political satire guaranteed to knock the rhetorical block off the Bush administration called Embedded, just off a successful run in Los Angeles and opening at New York's Public Theater Tuesday. Embedded follows the tribulations of reporters embedded with American troops in Iraq. Embedding reporters with units was a particular innovation in the coverage of this war. So, Tim, what makes you angry enough, if you follow Philip Roth's rubric, to write Embedded? I've read that more than the Bush administration, it was the media that drove you to it.
It was. I was in London in February when the whole build-up to the war was happening and the rationalizations were being made in the American media for it. You didn't really find that in London, which is encouraging that there's still a very strong independent media there. And I started examining, when I got home, the information that was being presented in that same time period in the United States, and I was really shocked. It was interesting to me that these two versions of reality could exist in two free societies. And for me, you know, there's a lot of issues being raised now that there was plenty of information about then. And I don't like this one-year delay on information. It's very unhealthy in a democracy.
Art isn't journalism, and it doesn't have to be fair or factual. And as the LA Times noted in a very favorable article, Embedded is as fair and balanced as a three-legged hyena. That's not the point, I guess.
Satire must have a base in truth. It has to have a base in truth, else it won't work. If you're talking about total fantasy, you can't satirize it. There has to be a core of truth that rings true to the audience for them to laugh. So that's not true. I think satire works best when it has something that people can recognize, but also doesn't pull its punches. It has to follow through with the punch. For me, what works is if you get to the core emotionally of what you feel they're all about and try to draw that out of the character, try to put that up on the stage.
Now, your depiction of the cabal around George Bush is pretty funny and pretty chilling. There's Dick, who I assume is Dick Cheney, Rum Rum, we all know who that is, Pearly White, who's Richard Pearl, Cove, who is Karl Rove, Wolf, who's Paul Wolfowitz, and Gondolo, which I guess is Condoleezza Rice?
Well, I have no comment.
So they're all followers of this political scientist Leo Strauss.
Yes. This is a political philosophy that is pretty shocking. It's kind of a belief in the noble lie, belief in the idea that there are two kinds of people. There are philosopher kings that can make the decisions, and then they're the masses, and they're maybe not informed enough to make decisions for themselves. And this goes against the grain of representative democracy or republic to such a degree that's incredibly dangerous. And the fact that no one knew who he was, and the fact that there's so many neocons in the administration that follow his philosophy and think it's a legitimate philosophy is truly frightening.
Now, your send-up of the war zeroes in on the preeminent media events, the controversial rescue of Private Jessica Lynch, the actual circumstances of which are still unclear. Your play suggests that it was entirely cooked up by the Pentagon.
Well, I was going off of information that I was reading in The Guardian in London. It was available a week after all this went down, when we were still buying into the fiction of the fact that she kept shooting and that she was this hero that was tortured in a hospital and all these things that they told us. In fact, what happened was The Guardian, practicing journalism, went and sent a reporter to that hospital to talk to the doctor and a couple of nurses who said that they, in fact, did take care of her. And I don't know if that is the absolute truth, but it's certainly probably more accurate, according to her book, about what happened, what went down.
Let's talk about the toppling of the statue, an event which, when it aired live, we all could see was sparsely attended and required the assistance of the U.S. military. It was later, of course, used as a kind of coda by the cable networks, and we've observed on this show that it was edited down, and when it was, it appeared larger and more spontaneous, the entire demonstration. Your play suggests that it was entirely staged.
Well, there was a wide shot taken, and you can probably find it on the internet. It shows there were about, 40, 50 people there. But it also shows that the square was cordoned off by tanks, so you couldn't get into the square unless you knew somebody or were approved. Whether it's staged or not, I don't know. I mean, sure, there's a lot of people that were really happy that it was gone and wanted to topple the statue. But the fact that that all happened right in front of the hotel where all the journalists were staying is a little suspect.
Let's move on to the portrayal of reporters. In your play, their stories had to be approved by the military chief there, a character that you call Hard Channel. But when the embedded process started, we read the rules of embedment issued by the Pentagon, and that wasn't in it. Reporters never had to submit their stories. They said they never would have agreed to it.
I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know that where they were kind of limited what they could write about. There's a quote from an embedded journalist from the Los Angeles Times, David Zucchino. He says, "I wrote stories I could not have produced had I not been embedded. Yet that same access could be suffocating and blinding. Often I was too close or confined to comprehend the war's broad sweep."
Right. Now, I wouldn't disagree with that for a moment. In fact, the principal criticism of the embedded process was that reporters were forced to see the war, and the cliche went, through a soda straw. But do you really believe that most of the reporters embedded in Iraq operated in bad faith and in violation of all the codes that ostensibly govern American journalism?
No, I don't. In the play, it also depicts a couple of journalists that do write what they want to write. The real question, I think, here is, as we're getting to a place as a country and as a society where we are able to question more about how we got to where we got, yes, we can hold the administration responsible for the deception that might have taken place to get us into this conflict. But shouldn't we also be asking huge questions about why the United States media didn't perform its function?
So there was the anger at the general tenor of the coverage here, which seemed pretty craven, I guess. Were you feeling some personal anger as well?
I think that's always been a good motivation for me to write. Anger is a place where I can really concentrate my efforts. I'm a very lazy writer, and I don't tend to sit down and really go after something unless I have a real motivation for it. And it had become personal. They had begun to involve my family. And they had begun to question my patriotism. And for me, that was where lines were crossed. And I felt I could either shut up and get with the program and be intimidated, or I could strike back in the way I knew how, which was to write something and to get it on to a stage.
Well, Tim Robbins, thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
Actor, director, playwright, and activist Tim Robbins, his play Embedded opens in New York's Public Theater Tuesday.
And now a few of your letters. A number of you thought I was way too easy on William Pierce, the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Pierce came on the show to defend a Medicare ad campaign that critics say uses taxpayers' money for ads that benefit the Bush administration politically. Manuel Schoenhorn writes, "I think you really fluffed it. The spokesman for HHS got away with half-truths and what can only be called administration propaganda. Why weren't you more aggressive in pushing the canned answers? Tired? Too cold in New York?" No, Mr. Schoenhorn, I live in Washington.
Bob's conversation with CBS correspondent Bill Plant about the sudden aggression in the White House press corps over the president's National Guard record prompted this from John Costa of New York City. What to think of the orgy of self-congratulation from the White House press corps at having shown a brief sign of life? It was pathetic. And keeping on the theme of Bob's faults, several people objected to his description of the New York Times' Paul Krugman as a lefty columnist in our show's promo. Scott Holmquist thinks Krugman is solidly in the mainstream and writes, "You must know that in the media you can find actual self-described leftists who are not fringe nuts but are fairly well-known and fairly widely read. Your shows are great, but please, if you want to talk left, how's about us hearing from an actual leftist?"
Whatever side you're on, and it would be fine if, you know, you had a letter to write about Miss Perfect, we want to hear from you. Write to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And even though no one ever does, we ask that you please tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, why car critics are not so critical of SUVs, and a close-up look at high definition. It's not pretty.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We all know that advertising affects consumers, and the auto industry is the nation's single largest advertiser. But as Keith Bradshaw observes in his newly updated book about SUVs called High and Mighty, when it comes to selling cars, ads are not especially influential. So why spend so much dough? Keith Bradshaw was formerly the New York Times Detroit bureau chief. Now he heads the Times Hong Kong bureau. Keith, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So the SUV is bigger, more powerful, and more expensive than a regular car, and you say so are its press junkets. When you walk into an auto industry press event, how do you know instantly whether it's for an SUV or a regular old car?
If it's for a regular old car, it tends to be a modest event held on city streets. If it's for an SUV, you're being flown somewhere exotic. The auto industry has flown plane loads of journalists to Outer Mongolia for the introduction of the Land Rover Discovery Series 2, to Phoenix, Arizona for the Ford Explorer, to Alaska for the Ford Expedition, to Belize for the new Acura model.
Back in their offices, away from the free food and the majesty of the mountains, can reporters recover their objectivity?
Some do and others do not. It is an advantage to change people among beats periodically. I think the longer anybody is covering any subject, often the closer they tend to get to the subject.
And there is a considerable revolving door between the journalists and the companies.
It's very hard to get journalists to move to Detroit. Once they're there, they tend very often to be hired by the automakers they cover. During the space of a few months, several years ago, Ford hired the reporters covering it for the Wall Street Journal, Fortune Magazine, Reuters. The Associated Press has lost, I guess, 5 out of its last 7 auto writers to working for the public relations arms of the automakers. So it is hard for news organizations to hold on to people against the considerably larger salaries, but more important, much better benefits that the auto industry does offer. And the strange result is that you go to a press conference 1 week and you're standing next to somebody who's asking questions, and the next week they're standing next to the executive receiving the questions.
But we've all heard for years that reporters who cover consumer goods tend to be susceptible to that kind of compromising position. Is it unusually prevalent, you think, in the auto industry?
Detroit is more of a company town. Now, that said, you certainly see caustic stories often about such and such an automaker is not selling well or such and such an executive is not doing well. But there is seldom in Detroit a basic questioning of the wisdom of where, for example, the entire industry may be going, as it was in the case of sport utility vehicles. There's seldom a questioning on environmental issues, where the automotive media tends to very much share the perspective of the auto industry. There's seldom a question on safety issues. There's a very strong hostility to any criticism of the industry on these kinds of broad points.
Let's talk about advertising for a moment. As you note in your book, the auto industry is the nation's number one advertiser, and yet you say only about 20% of car buyers are actually swayed by the ad. So what's the point of all that advertising?
The auto industry's advertising is roughly equal to the combined advertising of the next 3 categories. And those are all of telecom advertising, plus all of financial services, plus all of the national restaurant chain advertising. So it is an enormous amount of advertising, and it does make some difference. And for the auto industry, it's just a cost of doing business.
So if they're spending all of that money, and it influences perhaps 20% of car buyers, what about the influence on newspaper and magazine publishers? That's a big chunk of change.
In my book, I describe the example of what happened to Sierra magazine when, in late 1996, they ran an article that was mildly critical of the poor gas mileage of SUVs. And sure enough, all of their SUV advertising disappeared immediately, and that was 7% of the gross revenues of the magazine. And they had to run fewer pages of articles in subsequent magazines because they didn't have that SUV advertising. So that was a strong example of how dependent many publications are on automotive advertising. And there is to some extent, a chilling effect on coverage. Now, that varies by the news organization.
Does the auto industry have that much power to influence and perhaps even punish publications?
There is definitely an effort by the auto industry to find places to advertise their products that they perceive as providing a friendly or conducive environment for their products. Now, they like to say that that's not an effort to actually manipulate media coverage, but part of what they perceive as a friendly or conducive environment for their products is one that does not raise questions.
Okay. Keith Bratcher, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Keith Bratcher's book is High and Mighty, The Dangerous Rise of the SUV.
So now we have an idea of at least some of the reasons reviewers may love the SUV, but that doesn't explain the rest of us who buy SUVs even though they're incredibly expensive gas guzzlers that are environmentally rapacious and impossible to park. Last spring, we spoke to medical anthropologist Dr. Clotaire Rapai, who has been a marketing consultant for most major SUV manufacturers. He says the SUV's success grew of Detroit's failure to generate automotive sex appeal.
All these cars, they were boring and ugly. They look all the same. They had no identity. It's a little bit like the cars were telling you, well, I'm not so sure of myself. I don't dare to be a car. That's where the message of these intellectual cars designed by NAFTA that trying to get more aerodynamic and gas mileage. And then they were not sexy at all. So suddenly this SUV is, hey, the hell with you. I'm strong, I'm big, I'm taller than you, and I'm proud of being that.
If SUV marketing is about appealing to primal instincts, it would seem to me that the Hummer, which is possibly the most impractical automobile ever designed,
right?
The appeal must be practically bestial. One of the commercials shows a series of phrases, one after the other. And then you see the phrase, whatever. Is the message there, I own a Hummer, to hell with you?
Definitely something like that. I mean, I'm not behind this message, but there is something about feeling good about the hell with you, I do what I want, you see. And this is part of the American culture. And a lot of people resent this attitude around the world. You see, that's what a lot of people resent about this administration, where they say, the hell with you, we're going to go to war anyway. But on the other hand, there is something positive about it, because we know what we want and we do it, whatever it is.
With every technological advance, old media get new makeovers or face extinction. Tech mavericks Mark Cuban and Todd Wagner capitalized on this concept and together were one of the biggest success stories of the internet boom. They created Broadcast.com, which streamed radio and TV before most people had high-speed connections, and then sold it to Yahoo for $5.7 billion. Now they're tackling another medium, film, in high definition. Catherine Cuellar of KERA in Dallas has more.
It's pretty much accepted fact that films open at a local megaplex, then, over a period of months, make their way to DVD and video, and ultimately cable. But Dallas entrepreneur Todd Wagner wants to change that.
People that want to go to the theater, we want them to go to the theater. But you know what? If you don't want to go, you've got three kids at home, you can't get out that night, you can't get a sitter, I want you to be able to have the movie on DVD as well. At the same time.
Wagner's business partner, Mark Cuban, created HDNet, a satellite and cable TV channel exclusively for high-definition programs. There are other digital distributors out there, such as dot-com's Netflix and the film movement. What makes Wagner and Cuban different is they're not only distributing movies, they're making and showing them. Todd Wagner.
If I'd have said to you a year ago, yeah, we're going to make movies and, you know, maybe we'll put them on HDNet, but maybe we'll put them in the theater at the same time. People be like, well, that's nice. How are you going to convince the theaters to do that? They're always going to say, we need to run it first. Well, looks like we need to own some theaters then, doesn't it?
So, late last year, Wagner and Cuban bought Landmark Theaters, the nation's largest art house chain. They've also created a new company, HDNet Films, to make high-def movies for less than $2 million a pop. Their media company, 2929 Entertainment, also includes film and TV production, indie distributor Magnolia Pictures, and Reicher Entertainment's TV and film library. This farm-to-market integration makes New York Times film critic Elvis Mitchell a little nervous.
It's what the Justice Department did away with by divesting the studios of the theater chains in the 1940s. I would like to think that somehow it means that it'll be great for filmmakers who you can sort of get the attention of these guys and get them to go along with what you want to do, but these kinds of setups can end up being coercive and can end up being a real threat to independent filmmaking.
By law, Wagner and Cuban's venture cannot just show its own movies in their Landmark theaters. And Mark Butan, the newly announced head of 2929 Productions, says his bosses are not building a monopoly.
I think the main difference is, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, whenever those laws were originally passed, the only real outlet for a person to screen a motion picture was in a theater. And so if the producers controlled the theaters, there was really no alternative venue to get the picture out there. But today, you know, with DVD and video and cable television and pay-per-view and everything else, there's more avenues to distribution than one person can possibly control.
But the company controls Landmark's 204 screens across the country. It's a drop in the bucket by Hollywood standards, where major releases can open on as many as 3,500 screens, but those Landmark screens mean a lot to independents trying to show their work. Bart Weiss is board president of the Association of Independent Video and Filmmakers. He's concerned about vertical integration in the industry, but hopes Wagner and Cuban will be different.
If this were mainstream Hollywood, you know, things with star vehicles and all of that, you know, then there's some issues. But if this is an opportunity instead of being exclusive, but would include pieces that could come to the table that otherwise were outside of the mainstream, otherwise wouldn't get any be seen at all, and that they could get assistance to be produced and then to be distributed and to be exhibited, that could be a really good thing. So there's a great potential here.
And independent filmmakers like Rodney Lee Conover are excited about it. His high-def film, Bachelor Man, has won 14 festival awards since April.
They're still going to have to make good movies and acquire good movies and use fresh writing, directing, and acting talent. If they don't, it'll be the opportunity for someone else to spring up with a brand new idea in distribution and beat them at their own game.
So, with tech savvy, deep pockets, and business know-how, Cuban and Wagner aren't waiting to be beaten. Their creative team is working the festival circuit and ready for the pitch. For On the Media, I'm Catherine Cuellar in Dallas.
HDTV, the technology long just around the corner, has finally, at least to more affluent homes, actually arrived. With it comes a cinematic aspect ratio and better than cinematic resolution that promise to revolutionize the TV experience. But with every revolution comes unintended consequences. In this case, the fact that in addition to other startling detail, HDTV delivers large pores, red blotches, pancake makeup, and other cosmetic flaws hitherto imperceptible to the viewer eye. So there's a second revolution afoot in the makeup profession. Makeup artist Marianne Skiba has written about this in the current issue of Makeup Artist magazine, and she joins me now. Marianne, welcome to HD Not TV.
Thank you.
I've been in many a makeup chair in my career, and I'm always struck by how the makeup has always been applied with a trowel. I feel like Gloria, when I go on TV, I feel like Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard. Does everybody get made up like that, or are they just doing extra work on me because, you know, it's a tough case?
Well, no, I'm sure you're not a tough case, but I prefer to consider it an artful placement of the trowel. Certain things just have to be placed in certain places. Certain textures need to be used. A lot depends on what type of television it is, you know, what type of tape it's being shot on, and how it's lit. All of those things are big factors in a television as we currently know it, and they're going to be even bigger factors in high-definition television.
Television Week magazine ran a story about the travails of HDTV for some actors and I guess some makeup artists. They mentioned in particular Cameron Diaz, who looks like she has porcelain skin on the big screen, but in fact really has a substantial acne problem. Are people like Cameron Diaz in for a rude awakening in this brave new world?
I believe that at first everyone will be in for a bit of a shock. However, a lot of people are spending a lot of time addressing that particular thing. Now, most TV makeup artists are familiar with the skin detail chip, and certainly most performers are. And that is a chip within the TV cameras that can smooth out flesh tones and even out skins.
Like electronic gauze that just softens the skin tones when they're naturally uneven?
That's basically exactly what it is. And again, that will still be in place, but I feel its uses will be a bit more limited. The lighting is certainly being researched and corrected, and the colors are being balanced, and there'll be a certain amount of filtering involved. However, there is always that producer or director that wants that gritty, harsh reality that high definition can give. I don't think bare skin will ever be beautiful on camera, but we're accepting more things. We're not really having to trowel it on, so to speak.
So if the trowel is out, what will replace it? Tell me about airbrushing.
It just gives a much nicer effect to spray the makeup onto the skin, the face, the body. As with art and pointillism, those thousands of tiny, tiny little dots make up a picture. It's the same with airbrush. Those thousands and thousands of tiny little dots make up a breathable picture, and that's what's so nice about it. It's not as obvious, and that's the big problem with high definition, is a lot of this, especially the foundations and the powders that we're currently using, become very, very obvious. They lay on the skin. You don't see that on the current soap operas, but with high definition, you'll be able to pick out a lot of those things.
So is this why Barbara Walters is leaving 2020?
That I don't know. But I know that Katie Couric made a statement the other day on the Today Show that she's terrified of HDTV. And I would just like to say to Katie and to all the other on-air performers, just not to worry. We've got your back. We're professional makeup artists. We're working on it. We're excited by the challenge. We haven't had anything like this since the first days of television. I was always a little jealous of the old-timers in the industry that talked about, you know, how they would make something out of wax or putty or whatever they had access to. And now here, finally, in my career, I have the opportunity to start, you know, pulling tricks from my sleeves and invent and create. And boy, you know, no makeup artist worth their blush brush could pass up a chance like that.
All right, Marianne. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Marianne Skiba is a longtime makeup artist for the big screen, small screen, and now high-definition screen. She also chairs the HDTV division of the National Television Academy's New Media Committee. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo. Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.